It's because you're a collector. And
Yeah.
there's a difference between collecting because you love it and collecting because you're, making an investment. And they don't necessarily have to be mutually exclusive, because
Yeah.
you can have a, a little nice little middle ground where it's a Venn diagram where, even my comic collection, I buy what I like and all of that, but there's certain books I know have significant value, so those I try to store. I buy those reusable slabs. And the books like my X-Men number giant size X-Men number one, my Spider-Man 129, my Hulk 181, those
Nice.
are all in slabs.
Cool.
I just picked up this week at some point. I've had this conversation many times where I've tried to kind of make a finite number of each book of what I'm trying to collect. So like for example, for the series Daredevil, I decided I was going for issues 1 through 200, but beyond that I'm not. Once I get to 1 through 200, I feel like my collection is complete. And I just picked up issue number 2 this week,
Ooh.
so I am down to one issue that I need in that run of 1 to 200, and unfortunately, it's issue number 1. So
jeez.
I don't know if I'm ever going to find that at a price I'm willing to pay. But I got number 2. I brought it home and I put it into one of my reusable slabs because I
I
didn't
always
pay
laugh.
crazy money, but.
I always laugh when you say your stopping point for Amazing Spider-Man is 300, right? And you don't have that Venom issue, do you?
Yeah, I have a solid run from, I think it's number 42 to 299.
Right. That's what cracks me up. I'm like, oh, okay. And of course now everybody wants like an arm and a leg for that issue. So
I just saw something yesterday where they were saying they think the price is actually going to come down on that book because the print run was significant.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of good copies out there, and the people who are really willing to pay top dollar for them probably already have them. So they were saying that the price might actually drop some, and if it does, then I'll consider it, but I'm not willing to pay crazy money for that. I probably should have just said I'll make it, 1 to 250, and it would have made my life more simple. But I have, like I said, 42 to 299, and then I have one, two, let's see, what do I get? Between under four, under number 42, I have 3, 6, 9, 12, 15, 18, 21, 22 of the 22 of the 41 issues.
Nice.
My lowest one is number 10, or number 11, excuse me. I have nothing in single digits, but still a dream. But my wife, she was like, oh, you know what, you should just indulge yourself. That book you really want, you know what, take the money out of the bank, buy it. And she was talking about, she kept saying that Batman book, but what she meant was Amazing Fantasy 15. The problem is, she thinks if I get Amazing Fantasy 15, my life is complete and I'll stop buying comics.
Right. Well, yeah.
And that's not going to happen, because that's just going to make me need issues 1 through 41 even more.
Right.
And 300.
And 300. Well, that's how we are, right? Like that's why I told these guys I went out and I rebought all these old Generation One Transformers. They're loose, right? They're not in the package, but I got to go to a house sale. I got to mess around with them and transform them, make sure I wasn't buying a bunch of junk. And stand-up guy, right? So I bought a bunch of stuff. But now I'm in that state where I went to a show and I was like, oh, this guy has the same one for $15 without the gun, but I can transform it and then leave it in the truck mode. And then I'm like, does that mean I want to go buy all of them again and get the
This is where you
versions of
have them in
them,
both modes
right, in
next to
both
each other.
modes, right? Like that's where I am now, where I'm like, what did I do? But whatever. So
There's these rabbit holes we can fall
yes
down.
yes exactly.
Avengers Spotlight.
Yeah,
Hey guys, welcome back to Back to the Bins, Avenger Spotlight. Hey, what's up guys? This is Derek, Derek WC. I'm going to be one of your hosts tonight, but I am joined tonight by two fellow podcasters. I am joined by Paul Spatero. Hey, what's going on, Paul?
Not much. I think you're in my chair.
Yeah, I think I am. I think the last time we talked about this, I think I introduced you as producer Paul, and you said that I was producing this. So
I have ascended to executive producer.
Yeah, executive. I'm here with executive producer Paul Spatero.
Well, it's good to be here, and it's good to pass on the production duties to you right now, Derek. Thank you for taking them over.
Nice. And of course, I'm also joined by my fellow fanhole, my compatriot in arms for our Justice Not Entirely Dissimilar to Lightning podcast, which if you're a listener of that, you're of course in the right place because we're still continuing our coverage of Avengers Forever. But I've also got Mike on the phone with me tonight. Hey, what's up, Mike?
What's up? What am I in this like production hierarchy? Am I like the original creator of Justice?
Right. You have created by credit, right? Like you're the now if you're what Rob Liefeld wants, you are the Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster right at the beginning opening credits of this podcast.
Okay.
But if you're unfortunate because this is a Thunderbolts podcast and it's produced by Marvel, then you're just like a laundry list of names. Like at the end,
I'm a special thanks to at the end.
Yeah, special thanks to Mike and 50 other people who also contributed to the podcast, right? So, yeah. So yeah, we're here to discuss Avengers Forever. We are on our, I guess, third quadrant of Avengers Forever. So we'll be talking about issues 7 through 9. And I guess I'll get into the first issue that we're covering, which is, of course, Avengers Forever issue 7. The cover date was June 1999. The on sale date was May 12th, 1999. The cover price was a whopping $2.99. The cover credits were from penciler Carlos Pacheco and inker Jesus Moreno. The title of the story is Into a Limbo, Large and Broad. The writers, Kurt Busiek and Roger Stern, penciler Carlos Pacheco, inker Jesus Moreno, letterer Richard Starkings and comic crafts Albert Desheen, colorist Steve Olaf, editor Tom Brevoort. The Avengers travel through the time stream on top of one of Songbird's solid sound platforms that looks like a giant manta ray ship. They witness more discrepancies in their own history, such as the original Human Torch and the Vision, a past adventure with the Synchro Staff that guided the Avengers throughout history, and a moment where Captain America traveled into the past at the behest of Immortus. Soon enough, the chrono imagery vanishes, and the Avengers have arrived in Limbo. They head for Immortus's fortress, which appears to be frequently changing its appearance, which results in the entire team being disoriented and plummeting into separate locations. Hawkeye lands in a dark mausoleum with statues erected in his honor when the ice warrior Tempest attacks him. Cap winds up trapped in the castle dungeon with a World War II era Sergeant Nick Fury. The Wasp tries to follow Giant Man's voice, but is bombarded with different voices of Hank Pym from every corridor. Yellowjacket is finally shown a video of his future as Hank Pym, which he seeks to avoid by using the bugs of Limbo. Songbird appears in a darkened courtroom, judged by her peers, when Captain Marvel appears, telling her she needs to believe in herself and to fight the effects of Limbo dragging her down. Captain Marvel brings Songbird back to reality with a tender and comforting kiss. Hawkeye uses the powers of Goliath to take down Tempest. As Fury and Cap trade barbs, Fury's appearance changes from Sergeant to the CIA to the Director of S.H.I.E.L.D. Cap busts free of the dungeon, leaving the doubts of Limbo behind. Fury is revealed to be an inspirational form used as a disguise by Libra. Yellowjacket believes he will make first contact with Immortus, but Immortus believes him to be another attacking Avenger and traps him within a tube.
Giant Man fights his way through Immortus's Time Army to the Wasp, and she sends out the signal to the entire team to regroup. All the Avengers, with the exception of Yellowjacket, manage to return to Kang's Sphinx, where they discover Rick Jones,
bitch,
has gone off on his own into a chronosphere. The one saving grace is that Hawkeye managed to pick up the Synchro Staff while they were in Immortus's fortress. Meanwhile in Limbo, Yellowjacket makes an alliance with Immortus. In exchange for his continued existence, Yellowjacket will help Immortus destroy the Avengers. Next up, history in the breaking. And that, in a nutshell, is Avengers Forever, issue number 7. I guess maybe we'll start off with the cover of Avengers Forever, issue number 7. So I guess we've got a team shot with everybody there. What does everybody think of the cover?
Unfortunately, I am not a fan. And it starts with the fact that I'm not huge on Pacheco's art to begin with. I like the way he drew Captain America. It reminds me very much of a Gil Kane Captain America. But the shot of Yellowjacket getting stung in the butt by a songbird power blast just kind of takes any seriousness, any sense of danger out of this cover and almost brings it into like a comedic look. And I just really don't like that. The style issues aside, I just think the choice made to show him in that way is bad. Now, I'm fine with the fact that they're showing some sort of a friction between him and anybody else on the team, because I think that's where we're leading to in the story. But it's, again, it's almost a comedic pose, and I just don't like it at all.
See, I personally think that's not what's happening. I think it's just like Yellowjacket kind of leaping forward with like energy crackling behind his back, just because the energy that's crackling is like purple and Songbird stuff is pink.
And also those little digits that are like right beneath his thigh gap, I guess you'd call it, like that. Those are his hands. So I think what's going on is he's projecting himself. I mean, I agree that maybe it looks a little comical just in context of the rest of the images. Like Yellowjacket certainly stands out from all the other Avengers on the cover. But I think what Mike's trying to say is it looks like he's projecting himself with kind of like fist blasts or his wasp sting or whatever that is.
It is a very odd pose. Like he's jumping at you like crotch first, I think.
But, yeah. I mean, if that's what it is, if, you know, we'll just take for the moment the assumption that it is him projecting himself forward. If that's the case, I just think it's a poor choice of how it's drawn. Yeah. It's still from him reaching back to his butt with his arms and the look on his face. I'm still kind of going with my own
interpretation
of what's being shown here.
I can definitely see that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I do like the vibration of his, like, you know, shoulder pad wings or whatever. Like, I think that's a nice effect.
Yeah, I agree with you there. That it's, you know, the multiple images of the line work of his wings makes you think that they're moving along really fast. But then I never thought, and maybe I'm wrong, but I never thought he flew based on those. I thought those gave him, I always thought there was some sort of an armor effect of them. And I also thought that they somehow made him streamlined for the sake of directing himself as he flew. But I never thought he was flying with them as, you know, wings flapping.
Yeah, I must confess, I don't remember the mechanics of Yellowjacket's like costume or whatever. So I don't remember exactly what that means or does. I almost want to say like he built up like power blasts like that, like he, you know, his bio sting or whatever, like he would vibrate those to build up the power. But I don't remember.
If we go with your interpretation, then he's using that to build up the energy that he's then shooting out from behind him to project himself. But then again, I always thought he could, well, you know what? I always thought he could fly without doing that, but that was in his miniature form. I don't think I ever saw an instance where he was able to fly in his full human size.
I mean, I like the way Giant Man looks amongst like the, basically what is Immortus's ever-changing fortress or castle or whatever. And I think that gives good perspective, or the environment kind of enhances Giant Man's being.
giant. You know what I mean? Like that you can see the regular Avengers are kind of within the castle walls and the rubble and everything, but that giant man is like using the pillars and things to kind of like dig his way out of where he is, that kind of thing. And if Songbird is, I guess, blasting Yellow Jacket in the butt or whatever, well, he probably deserves it, right? Like at least the way the relationships have been going on, you know, in the series to this point.
Yeah, no, that I'm totally on board with, that, you know, they are definitely, there's definitely a level of animosity there. And it's true to the way Yellow Jacket, from the era he's taken from, you know, it's true to that attitude that he had at that time. He was arrogant. He didn't know he was Hank Pym. He thought he was this brash, you know, superhero that was going to, you know, sweep the girl off her feet and all of that. So the animosity makes sense. I think that's very well presented in these stories.
So for I know for the interiors, one of the things that I kind of wanted to discuss was, I guess, you know, like they all board, I guess what I was calling like Songbird's like sonic manta ray thing, that they all jump in that ship and they're sort of traversing, you know, the limbo of time and seeing all these kind of moments from Avengers history that can be really cool if you're a longtime fan, right? You can do the Leo DiCaprio thing and point and go, ooh, I know that thing or whatever. But the Songbird aspect of it, I mean, it's definitely like a future Songbird, because I think for me and Mike, like we're covering Thunderbolts issues, you know, chronologically, you know, issue by issue. And this, I guess, projection that she has is far exceeds anything that she's ever been able to do in the series up to the point where we covered, and we're somewhere in the 20s. And this is like a future version of her that has joined the Avengers, that obviously is well established with the Avengers and has a lot more experience. And so I guess I just, you know, kind of wanted to toss it to Mike, like what he thinks about that, and the fact that, you know, we have that Thunderbolts, you know, podcast, and, you know, Songbird is obviously a huge part of that.
Yeah, there is a certain sense of progression, because like in the books we're reading, like right now, it's like, I mean, she makes wings and she makes like battering rams and giant maces and stuff. But here, like, it seems like she's up to like, you know, Kyle Rayner like level, like, you know, constructions and stuff. Like, so, you know, I always thought, you know, I'm a big booster for Songbird, and I'm always like, man, like someone should use her more. Like her powers are so like visually interesting. Like, you know, if you want a Green Lantern like sort of substitute, you could do worse than her.
Yeah, I definitely feel like that's definitely one of the aspects from this maxi series that I wish had been fully realized, right? Like that Songbird had really been picked up. I mean, she had some more authority, I think, within the Thunderbolts as that book continued, and they've gone back to that character periodically. But I don't think this whole notion of her being a fully formed and realized essential member of the Avengers at some point was ever really, you know,
she was part of. Like a few years back, like, well, probably more than a few, but she was part of that. I think the book was called like US Avengers or something. And she was part of that team. Like it was led by Bobby DaCosta, a Sunspot. And she was like a member of that team. And like they even had a call out to like Avengers Forever where she said, I forgot, she said like, you know, like in the last issue, she was like, oh, yeah, like, hey, you know, Songbird Avengers. And she's like, Avengers Forever. Yep. Uh-huh. And I was like, well, I mean, this wasn't really, you know, an A-list Avengers team she was on. So, I mean, I don't think it counts. But
even, I find it interesting in this choice of members of this squad. You know, the inclusion of Songbird and the inclusion of Captain Marvel, just because they are future versions. You know, everybody else is, they're giving us, you know, it's either the current iterations at the time this came out or the past iterations that, you know, from timelines that we can, you know, that we can put our fingers on. But this is supposed to be limbo where time is not a factor. So it makes total sense that there would be characters from the future. And we learn in this issue that they're not even from the same timeline or from the same time period, because he is further along in time than she is, because there's the part where they discuss that, you know, he's kind of sad because they had a relationship and mm-hmm. she isn't even aware of it because she's from an earlier incarnation than that. So I just think that's a pretty cool thing that Busiak did in choosing these members, because when you look at the team, it kind of leaves it up in the air, like, why would you choose these members? And from a strategic point of view, I haven't gotten the feel for that. But from a writing and interesting story point of view, I think it's pretty cool, the choices that he made.
Yeah, I mean, I know you kind of jumped into it, but I think, you know, I've sort of espoused, like, I'm kind of a fan of the Genesvel Captain Marvel. And I was kind of a Wednesday warrior reading that book from month to month. But I also... That's one of those things that I'm kind of sad about, that I feel like was never fully completely realized, like that their relationship, which I really liked in this. And I sometimes look at some of the original art pages in my collection and I think, like, oh, I must have a thing for kissing pages, because, you know, I've got some where Clark and Lana are about to have a kiss and things like that. And so I look at this and just kind of go, oh, this is a nice, you know, like I just like this moment. But it's also kind of bittersweet to me, because we kind of have some insight into the actual future. And it's like, it to me, sometimes it is a shame where you realize that some of these things just were never fully realized, I guess, just because, you know, either Busiak wasn't writing the title long enough for that to happen, or it just other people didn't pick up the breadcrumbs that were laid down. But I mean, as far as like past stuff goes, I mean, like on that DPS, you've got like the whole "even an android can cry" kind of moment on that, that's kind of homaged. And for me, I was growing up reading Burns' West Coast Avengers, so like this whole kind of notion of, you know, oh, the Torch and the Vision, that we thought they were the same, but they're not the same, and they're kind of slowly going back and forth between these contradictory moments, I guess, like the shot of Professor Horton in that first opening title DPS, I guess, that's supposed to establish, like, look, in that, in Marvel's, you know, the Alex Ross book, they establish, like, the Human Torch had organic parts, basically, right? Like, he's an android, artificial human, but he was made with organic parts. But yet, in other iterations, right, where Roy Thomas wrote the backstory, or the different iterations of the Human Torch, they talked about how he had mechanical parts. And now they're trying to reconcile, like, all these sort of contradictions. And I don't know, I made Busiak's last name like an adjective, like somebody's trying to Busiak that shit. Do you know what I mean? Like they're trying to figure it out, right? Like
so. I do love when Giant Man makes that observation. He was like, wait a minute, I said both those things, but they like contradict each other. Wait, so what happened there? Like, you know.
The only thing, and I think I've mentioned this in the past, is I do feel like he's hitting us over the head with a hammer with the, you know, Cap is sad.
Mm.
I don't think he needs to remind us of it quite as often as he does. You know, even the, you know, the Schleprock Cap on the first page of the story, I'm not sure who's saying, you know, come on, Cap, buck up.
It's
everything will work out fine. You know, it's a little much. I just, Captain America is a warrior, and I could understand him losing faith. I could understand him just kind of having a question about his own role as far as the country goes with what went on with the Secret Empire storyline. But I thought Englehart, when he wrote that storyline, handled it pretty well. I thought it made sense. Whereas this, you know, the self-pitying Cap just seems to take it just a step too far for me.
If I'm not mistaken, isn't Hawkeye normally the guy that usually kind of talks Cap off the ledge in a lot of those kind of storylines? Like,
so, in that actual storyline, right? He did. When Cap, you know, Steve Rogers gave up being Captain America following the Secret Empire storyline, and he was just not doing anything. And Hawkeye actually attacked him dressed as the Golden Archer. Hmm. And I believe it was before we actually had the Golden Archer appear, you know, in any storyline with the Squadron Supreme or the Squadron Sinister. I think that was the introduction of the character. And anyway, you know, he finally Cap ends up taking him down, and then he's like, hold on, it's me, it's Clint. And he says, you know, basically, I wanted to snap you out of this and let you know that you still serve a role, even if you're not Captain America. And that's when he took on the role of Nomad for, I don't know, two or three issues.
And then there's that issue, like, right after Galactic Storm, where Hawkeye gives him a pep talk after he's all depressed about the Supreme Intelligence being killed. Yeah,
I just think that's Hawkeye's natural instinct. So maybe Cap isn't as schlep rocky as Hawkeye is, just looking to, like, snap him out of any schlep rock he perceives, maybe, you know, like, so, but yeah,
I'm perceiving too much schlep rockness. Can we make that into
an adjective?
An adjective, yeah.
Schlep rocky.
Again, like, all the nods to classic stories, you know, what is it, Avengers 10, where they have the Avengers fighting Immortus. You know, I grew up reading the Marvel Masterworks, so again, I can be Leo DiCaprio, and, you know, like, I know that, I recognize that, like, that's always fun to see in these. The other thing that I did really like about this is Hawkeye's moment in this, like, fighting Tempest, like the Ice Warrior, because I think it's just, I guess, from the perspective of that he not only uses his, you know, archer skills, but then he goes back to doing the Goliath mode to kind of take down the Ice Warrior. But he also kind of has this second win because he basically is encouraged or reinforced. You know, he talks about how the Wasp chose him to be the leader of one of the squads. And this kind of gives him just a little bit of future knowledge, like that people have faith in him, that he's meant for bigger and better things. And, you know, this kind of gives him, like, this, you know, round two power to kind of, you know, take down the big bad. And, you know, I don't know. I enjoyed that whole fight and moment with Hawkeye.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I think, like, he comes off really well in that fight with Tempest. Like, it's like, you know, it's easy to overlook. Tempest shoots him with the de-evolution beam because, you know, he takes notice of the fact immediately that the first stop on that de-evolution beam would be, you know, him being Goliath. So, like, that's, you know, he, you know, he has the keen, like, tactical mind. And I also like that bit where he, you know, he goes nuts on, like, Tempest and beats him up and says, like, hey, you know, I got potential and I'm not done using it. So, yeah, it's a really good showing for Hawkeye.
Yeah. Yeah.
I agree. I think that's really well done, and that, you know, he knows what's coming and he takes advantage of it. And that shows, you know, that he kind of learned his tactical way of looking at things from Cap. So, you know, that creates a little bit more of a connection there. I really got a kick in this about how they depict Limbo as being, you know, basically an Escher painting. I thought that was just a cool effect and well done. You know, the fact that everything's changing at all times and that, you know, they fall sideways and, you know, just different things. And then everybody falls into something where they're being tested. And it's just, you know, it's a cool breakdown. And everybody passes the test except Yellow Jacket, who fails miserably.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, is Yellow Jacket's test is just realizing he's actually Hank Pym? Like, I don't even, like, and, I'm not even sure what, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's realizing, you know, who he really is. And then, you know, the test is to see if he can come to grips with it. And he can't.
Yeah, because
he's ready to sell out the team.
Uh-huh. Yeah, most of these people, they have to face maybe not their worst fears, but certainly things that are foremost on their mind as fears and concerns. You know, Songbird has to encounter that sort of mock trial of all these people that she's afraid that she's done wrong, right? And I mean, I wouldn't say Songbird overcomes that by herself, but with the help of Jennisfell, you know, she does finally get past it. And then, you know, I'd say the same thing about Hank and Jan, you know, or Giant Man and Jan. You know, they both look out for one another, and that's their strength in getting past this. You know, Cap kind of ultimately comes to his senses, maybe due to some help, some nudging from Libra, right?
But I guess it is true what you guys are saying. I mean, we've already talked about, we've already waxed Hawkeye's car. And then the only person left is Yellow Jacket, who basically is now poised to be the Judas to the Avengers Forever squad, I guess, right?
Mm-hmm. And I got to say, despite my criticism of the stylistic nature of the artwork, there are some parts in this where I think it's beautiful. The very last page, I think, is terrific. But, you know, even beyond that, what is it? The pages aren't numbered, unfortunately. You know, when they show Immortus's horde,
You mean the one where he's saying, like, destroy them all?
Or yes, the last panel on that page, which kind of just gives me the feel of George Perez combined with Kirby Crackle.
Yeah. Because it's got that radiating Kirby Crackle kind of in like a circular motion. Yeah. And that's got all the different like time armies of Immortus. Yeah.
So, you know, it just brings me back to my criticism of the artwork in this is more based upon the fact that I'm not totally on board with the style as opposed to my criticizing the actual execution of the style. I think the execution is very well done. It's just that I'm, you know, not totally on board with his stylistic nature.
Yeah, that's fine. I mean, not everybody's style is for everybody, right? Like,
I just wanted to mention, like, I know you, like, you know, you're a big fan of like Jenis Fell, Derek, and like, I'm not so much. Well, not like I like him; he's fine, but I don't know. I'm not I didn't read his book, like, and I don't know. I feel like I have thoughts about, you know, him and Songbird together. Like, I always
right.
You know, Abe and Songbird.
And I mean, there is some representation of that, but it's almost like they're trying to clue us in that, like, I mean, at least from my perspective, like, I don't know if you considered this or not, but the fact that he's the basically the judge in this fictional jury against her, like, it almost is trying to give you a hint, like, maybe that ship that you liked so much isn't going to turn out so well. You know what I mean?
Yeah, in the future. Uh-huh.
I mean, I get what you're saying. You're like, hey, who's this Jenis Fell dude making time with Songbird when she should be with Abe? But even before that, it's like, well, it seems like somewhere along the way she messed up with him too, right? Like, so, and maybe that's not necessarily a reflection on him, but I mean, I guess it depends on, you know, how she feels about it, right? Because she's obviously putting a lot of burden or pressure on herself, right? Which, you know, I guess Jenis Fell is relieving in this case.
Ladies and gentlemen, meet your Thunderbolts.
The Thunderbolts, are they the exciting new heroes the world needs?
Thunderbolts, strike!
Today makes at least half a dozen times the Thunderbolts have done the job we used to depend on the Avengers for.
It allowed us to move among you, disguising who we really are. The Masters of Evil!
In what is now becoming an old story, the Thunderbolts once again save the city.
Enough of this hero talk. You will do as you're told.
But...
He's right. You may be wearing a Songbird costume, but underneath you're just screaming me.
I can expose all of you right now. So you see, you really have no choice.
You know what? We're done playing these parts.
It's time to live these parts.
No one betrays Zemo.
Figures, just when we go all in on this hero thing, our blood runs out.
Avengers, Defenders, Thunderbolts, I make any team better.
We're Norman Osborn's A-team, and he's the big man in charge now.
This isn't the team I used to lead.
You, honey, are under arrest.
You have to fight for what's right. Every single day, bulletproof skin or not.
The Thunderbolts have worked hard to change people's minds about us, but apparently we've got a ways to go.
Justice, not entirely dissimilar to Lightning, a Thunderbolts podcast, now playing on fanholespodcast.blogspot.com. But yeah, if we're good on issue 7, do you guys want to move on to the next issue?
Sure.
Okay. So Avengers Forever issue 8, same credits. The title is The Secret History of the Avengers. As Hawkeye literally wrestles with the Synchro Staff, the Wasp is trying to get answers from the Avengers from the future eras, such as Captain Marvel and Songbird. Captain Marvel doesn't wish to upset the delicate balance of time, and Songbird only knows so much as she was only recently inducted into the Avengers. To the shock of the Avengers, when Hawkeye threatens to break the Synchro Staff, it reveals its true form as yet another Space Phantom. The Avengers begin to interrogate the Space Phantom. The Phantom tells them once Rama Tut, then Kang, then finally Immortus reached his final form, that he served as the agent of the Timekeepers, the mysterious trio of aliens from issue number 1, kids! He goes on to tell the Avengers how anyone not protected by the Timekeepers will turn into the one of many Space Phantoms in Immortus's army. This particular Space Phantom is the OG who fought the original team lineup. He recounts Immortus's own history with the early Avengers and how he decided to defy the Timekeeper and shepherd the Avengers rather than destroy them. The Space Phantom not only recounts Thor's adventures in Limbo, but a sly nod to the Superman vs. Spider-Man Treasury Edition with Luthor and Doc Ock busting out of jail. Space Phantom explains that the Timekeepers were most displeased with the events of the Kree-Skrull War and the possible future that led to the creation of the Galactic Avenger Battalion and the Terran Empire. In addition to wanting humanity confined to Earth, Immortus also had great interest in the Scarlet Witch and her children. He manipulated events so that the Scarlet Witch would marry a machine and thus have no children. Her magic defied that logic, and the two children were born despite Immortus's careful planning. Professor Horton was later replaced by a Space Phantom, causing even more confusion. Ultimately, Captain Marvel explains that Immortus split the original Human Torch in two, and that both eventualities of the Vision and the original Human Torch would come to pass in Avengers history. The trauma the Scarlet Witch suffers when the Vision is dismantled and rebuilt weakens her bond with her children enough for Mephisto to reclaim her children. Space Phantom reveals Operation Galactic Storm, The Crossing, and even Onslaught were also events that Immortus played a part in manipulating. As the Avengers reflect on these revelations, Captain Marvel's cosmic awareness warns them that something is coming for them. Too late to react defensively, the Avengers lie defeated at the hands of Yellowjacket and Immortus. Next, Reflections of the Conqueror. So yeah, so we're on issue 8 of Avengers Forever. And I guess we should stop and take a look at the cover.
I do like that, like Immortus like splitting the Vision and the Torch in two. Like, that's cool.
I agree. I think I like the fact that the covers are giving us, you know, some feel for what's going on inside. It's not just poster covers. And yeah, splitting them in two, and I guess, you know, it's symbolic of splitting their histories. What I didn't really get in this issue, I'm sorry to jump right into it, but maybe you could kind of give me an idea if you see more of it, is why was Immortus so obsessed with keeping the Avengers around and you know, allowing them to exist in their form, as opposed to just kind of decimating them and moving on?
I feel like that all ties into maybe what happens in the next issue, or the fact that Immortus is Kang, like, you know, that they're constantly in flux. Like, I kind of feel like he's almost like, and I don't know if this will be an acceptable analogy, but I feel like Immortus is the Q to the Avengers, you know, Star Trek The Next Generation Enterprise crew. That, like, he's not there to, like, just wipe them off the face of the map. Like, he's trying to, like, I don't know, preserve them, nudge them. Like, he respects their tenacity, their drive, like all these positive qualities that maybe you and I see in the Avengers. But then I see what you're saying. Like, I sort of appreciate the dichotomy of it. It's kind of like you're kind of coming at it from like the Scott Evil perspective of like, dude, why don't we just go get a gun? Why don't we just shoot the Avengers? And it's like, no. We have to have an elaborate plan. You know, we have to do some crazy time hijinks first, you know, and you're like, come on, man. But I mean, I think that's supposed to be, from my perspective, that's supposed to be the notion.
Well, the point where that seems to be problematic to me, because I get all of that and that makes sense the way you're presenting it. But the problem where it's, or the area where it seems problematic is that he's risking his own existence with these Time Lords, where they're gonna, you know, take out their wrath on him because he's not doing what they want him to do. So he's really taking, you know, his own personal risk here, as opposed to just overseeing it and saying, let them exist.
But don't you think they're so intrinsically tied together? Like, imagine, I mean, I don't know, I'm just playing devil's advocate, but say like Immortus does what they say and he wipes the Avengers out of existence. Like, without the Avengers, he never really has those battles with them as Kang. He doesn't do all the things that he needs to do to make him Immortus either, right? Like, wouldn't, I don't know. I know that's like a time travel headache thing, but I feel like that would impact him almost as much as it would. Like, wiping out the Avengers may very well, maybe not wipe him out, but certainly change the entire fabric of who he is.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I keep coming back in my mind to your analogy of Q with the Enterprise crew, where he, you know, he feels the need to torture them, but he also has a grudging respect for Picard.
Yeah.
You know, so I can kind of go with that a little bit, except, like I said, when he starts putting himself into risk. But, you know, I guess maybe that's just the nature of the being. And then, like you said, the dichotomy with Kang being also a version of him, you know, it's a factor, I guess. And he's got this imperious way about him, too, where, you know, he probably feels like it's almost like, you know, when Dr. Doom is confronted by, you know, Galactus and just feels like, well, I, you know, not only am I not afraid of him, but I'm going to figure out a way to, you know, usurp his powers from him.
I mean, I guess, yeah. I guess I can see the point of view that if, you know, that the whole idea that he has bosses. You know what I mean? Like, because maybe you tend to think of Immortus as the big bad, but then it's like, oh, wait, like he has to sort of kowtow to what the timekeepers tell him to do, too. So it's like everybody's got a boss somewhere, I guess. Right.
I think, you know, the very nature of it, that Immortus is an older, more mature Kang, like he's just nostalgically fond of them. Basically, like, you know, and like you said, I mean, they, no doubt his battles with them made him who he is. So, I mean, like, I guess, you know, or maybe it's just something technical where like the Avengers are a, you know, temporal cornerstone or something and can't be like effed with like too much. Like, so,
I mean,
yeah, no, I mean, it all makes sense. It's just, I think it's one area where the story could have just made it a little bit more clear. They could have given us just a little bit, you know, more in the way of his motivations.
I know. I guess I'm extremely fond of Avengers 2, where the Space Phantom first shows up. Like, it is one of my favorite Avengers stories. So I guess the fact that, you know, Hawkeye manages to shake the synchro staff so that it turns into that OG version of the Space Phantom, you know, that character plays a role, that they have some callback to that second issue and sort of set up, you know, kind of, you know, the role the Space Phantom plays in this and how they sort of, I guess, extend that to, you know, oh, well, you know, I guess now it's like, you know, everybody says, oh, well, it was a Doom bot. Like, that's their excuse. Like, in this case, the Busicking of it, you know, the continuity cleanup is, okay, well, now we've got this out that, like, if something was really dumb, guess what? A Space Phantom did it, you know, like, type of thing. And it's like, okay, well, that's, I don't know, whatever. Like, I think that's fun. You know, I mean, you know, sometimes it works out to my advantage, right? Like, I don't think there's too many people who are going to argue about kind of cleaning up the crossing by saying, oh, it was just a bunch of Space Phantoms, right? I mean, I love Operation Galactic Storm. So I could leave it the way it is. Like, I don't need any extra excuses or you know, additional manipulation or influence to justify that story to me. But if that makes people sleep easier at night, like, it's fine too, right? Like, I'm kind of thrilled that all this stuff is considered integral and important enough that I think they wanted to get it all straight and line it all up and sort of put it in a form where hopefully it would make sense to everyone as a consistent narrative. Whereas, yes, these are comics. Yes, they're written by a bunch of different people and they're not always consistent. But I think this is, you know, I don't know. To me, it's just fun. It's a fun way to tie this together. It's yes, this is heavily laden with continuity, but I sort of enjoy that, you know, the whole aspect of that Immortus wants to keep them out of space because every time they get into space, it sort of devolves into this Terran Empire thing, right? And so it's always fun when they start teetering on the edge of things, whether it's like the Kree Skrull War, Galactic Storm. It's like, I've always enjoyed that kind of superhero space opera stuff. And I know Mike is a little different than me in that regard, but maybe that speaks to him, you know, that Immortus is like trying to be like, hey, get out of this space business. We just want people to do superheroics on Earth or whatever. I don't know, but does that speak to you at all? I don't know.
A little. Well, I think it's amusing that Busick seems to be saying that much of like Iron Man's attitude during like Len Kaminsky's run of Iron Man, which is like my favorite run of Iron Man, was due to him being like emotionally like effed with by Kang. Or Immortus, because I'm kind of like, man, I like that run of Iron Man. So I don't think, I mean, yes, he's a little like, you don't see any of the Robert Downey Jr. Iron Man in that run. Like, you know, he's Tony Stark, you know, like sort of, you know, part of the more serious, edgy 90s sort of. So he does kind of have a more hard edge to him. But also, you know, he was like, especially during Galactic Storm, he was kind of like dying at that point. Like his nervous system was failing. So of course he would be like edgy and like, you know, maybe his decisions would be a little more, you know, permanent and harsher. So I don't know if like, it's funny. I don't know if he needs to be like, you know, that characterization needs to be like explained as some like outer like thing affecting him. Like, I mean, and if you look even further into the future, it's like, well, Tony Stark's also the guy who like, you know, starts the, you know, superhero Civil War and like does all this other shady stuff. So, I mean, was that all Immortus too? Like, I mean, like anytime Tony Stark is a big dick, like it's Immortus, like, you know.
But I mean, it's funny. I guess you have to pick and choose, right? I think the me that read this back when this came out, like I, you know, no matter what, I love Operation Galactic Storm, but I will own up to the fact that when they start going into the bomber jackets era of Avengers, when they start bringing up Death Cry, and they basically at that point the Timekeepers are like really not happy with how things are going with the Avengers, I think there is some aspect to me where I go, see, like the, you know, the crossing and all that stuff was lame, right? But meanwhile, maybe I got Luke Giaconetti in my ear going, shut up, Derek, like the crossing was cool, or like we like that stuff, like leave our stuff alone or whatever. But like, you know, I guess this is the big giant, you know, sweater to unravel, I guess. And I mean, you know, I love that John Byrne Avengers West Coast run, but I mean, there's certainly, you know, pot shots fired at that as well, right? Like he's basically trying to reconcile a bunch of stuff within the epic. And to me, I think in between that, you still get like fun stuff. Like to me, I'm like, oh boy, like there's Doc Ock with Lex Luthor. Like how cool is that? They snuck Lex Luthor into this story. Like it's, I don't know, like stuff like that. I'm like, I can't help but get like super duper giddy over, because I think it's fun.
I think the Space Phantom / Immortus get out of jail free card is a useful tool. You know, I mean, I've seen, you know, you mentioned earlier the Doombots, and they definitely have made use of that, where, you know, Doom has been defeated in ways where, you know, if you look at it belittles him somehow. So anytime they look back on that, they're going to say, well, that was a Doombot. They did the same thing with Thanos. I think it was the story The End, possibly.
Oh, right. They always talk about simulacrums, right? Like basically, yes. Like if like me, like if your butt hurt and you go, why did Thanos lose to Kazar in his comic or whatever? They say, oh, don't worry about that, because when Thanos shows up in the ongoing Captain Marvel, the Genisfell book, he basically says, oh, that wasn't me. That was just a malfunctioning simulacrum. Like basically, that guy wasn't the real me, you know, like
yeah, it was a shadow of him.
Right. Right. And you sit there and you go, like if you're a fanboy of Thanos, right, you're like sitting there going, oh, of course, that makes perfect sense. Right. Like, so, I mean, you know, it depends on like who you are and what you're a fan of and all that kind of good stuff.
And also it depends on how far they go with it, too. You know, in The Crossing, you know, and apologies to Mike, you know, Tony Stark was probably just a little bit too much of a dick. So we had to, you know, we have to pull that back a little bit, you know, whereas you could make him a little dicky, but you can't go too over the top, which they did in that. So, you know, that we're going to blame that on Immortus. And that all seems fair to me.
I think it's like one of those things where we talk about this quite often, usually in regards to somebody like Cyclops, but it's like you can have your guy walk the tightrope and make hard decisions and do things that other people wouldn't normally do. But the minute you're kind of at a loss is when your guy falls off the acrobatic, you know, tripwire or balancing beam or whatever it is. And I, you know, to me, The Crossing, it's like, oh, they got Tony Stark murdering people and all kinds of, you know, wacky. I mean, that was basically, The Crossing was the equivalent of, you know, Hal Jordan becoming Parallax, right? Like that was, mm-hmm. that was the tit for tat for between the universes. Right. And so you have to have something to explain that away, right? Because somebody's got to come back from it. I mean, I think, you know, the Galactic Storm stuff, you know, that people could have lived with that and it didn't need to be explained away. Just like I think Mike was talking about his attitude in the Len Kaminsky run. But I think once you get into the point where, you know, he what was that nanny's name, Mike, that he kills? I can't remember.
Marilla,
he kills Marilla, and you're like, what's he doing? Kill it. You know, like that, you sort of have to have a get out of jail card for.
There's a difference between him being a dick and him being a straight up villain. So, I mean, I'm not sure I buy that Immortus was like influencing him all through the Len Kaminsky run. But like, you know, when he starts killing, poor inhuman nannies and whoever else he killed. The female Yellow Jacket he killed, too. So, okay. Like, when he starts doing that stuff. OK, well, that's, you know, Immortus, like, you know, manipulating him. So.
Yeah, so it's a get out of jail free card. That's really what it comes down to. Uh-huh. You know, you could have your story and then we could pull it back and you don't have to work. You know, because ultimately in these books, they always have to be able to come back to status quo. Unless you're going to change the status quo, which is rare. But even when they change the status quo, usually we still come back to the status quo eventually.
Yeah.
So, you know, there always seems to be, you know, we go to a certain distance and then there's a back to basics kind of feel to the way the series is presented. And I mean, when I say series, I mean all of them, all of their significant IPs. You know, they're going to ultimately want to bring it back because ultimately the fans want to have the character they fell in love with. They're not going to want to have, you know, the legacy hero in most cases. It happens occasionally, but it's rare. Sometimes they want to have your original hero and your legacy hero. I think that's the more common thing. You know, that's ultimately what, you know, I think we got with Green Lantern. They wanted to have Hal Jordan and Kyle Rayner and Jon Stewart
and
Guy Gardner.
I do love Hawkeye's reaction to hearing about The Crossing. This is crackers.
I mean, you know, there's, I mean, even Cap, I mean, and this is, I'll own up to this. This is full on Schlepprock Cap where he's like, no more, please, no more. Is this what we are fated to endure? Is there no way out? Like that, I guess, is part and parcel. Yes, he's being Schlepprocky, but I also think he's kind of speaking for like all the fans that didn't like The Crossing that had to suffer through it too, right? Where they're like, is there no way out of this? Like, can we have Franklin undo all this, please? Like,
but I thought that, you know, what's his name? Libra got him out of the Schlepprock phase. So why we fall back into it right in the next issue?
Mm. I guess I kind of wanted to ask you guys, because I don't know, maybe my answer is a foregone conclusion since I'm a big fanboy of this entire Maxi series or whatever. But going back to the cover, Immortus splitting the Vision and the original Human Torch. Like, do you guys enjoy the exercise, as it were, to like line up all these various disparate sort of conflicting and or confusing interpretations of the Torch and the Vision to ultimately come to the conclusion the get out of jail card is fine. Immortus just made two different versions of the Torch and one became the Vision and one is the original Human Torch?
The answer from that doesn't really sit well with me, but ultimately, and I think the biggest reason it doesn't sit well with me is because when I started reading, you know, we were just about onto the Celestial Madonna storyline, and that was the explanation. You know, they really went into how the Human Torch became the Vision. Mm-hmm. So therefore, I don't like to see that contradicted. On the other hand, I do like having the original Human Torch still around as a character. And if I want to have my cake and eat it too, I have to accept this version, which at least gives a logical reason for it.
I'm curious because I don't know the answer to this. Like, did you read those Avengers West Coast issues? Because I mean, for me, that it was just me as a kid buying them from the comic store as they came out, and I just it kind of like they're having that conversation about why are we saying these things that are contradictory. Like, I feel like I was the guy who just accepted it at face value because I was a little kid reading these comics or whatever. But like, were you also sort of taken off guard or aback in the same way, like when Byrne introduced that, like basically going, we fooled you, like everything you thought you knew isn't what you knew, the Vision isn't the Human Torch, dun dun dun. Like, did that throw you, or is that something that you never really kept up with at that particular point in time?
Well, that's exactly it. I had not been keeping up with it when it was coming out.
Okay.
By the time I obtained those West Coast Avenger issues, this storyline had already come out. You know, there was a stretch there when I wasn't buying comics, and you know, the Byrne West Coast Avengers point was in that window. So it was kind of swept under the rug for me until it had an explanation. I came back into comics in the early to mid 90s. So, you know, I'm trying to think when the Byrne Avengers were 89. So yeah, I was definitely not purchasing at that time. That was when I was too grown up to buy comics. Then luckily I got older and realized I wasn't.
Hey, what about you, Mike? Like, what do you think of the whole reconciliation of Vision and the Torch? And to me, I guess I'd say it as like, okay, there was the officially established thing, which Paul is talking about. They went to great lengths to say the original Human Torch became the Vision, the end. Like, that's the final word on it. And then Byrne retconned it and said, wait, no, that's not true. We get to have our cake and eat it too. There's the Human Torch, original, and the Vision. And then now Busick's looking at all of that kind of going, well, none of that all kind of lines up or makes any sense. So I'm going to try to make heads or tails of this. So like, as a writing exercise, what are your thoughts on that? Like, do you think it landed for you or not?
I mean, like, sidestepping the whole tangled knot of continuity there, it's like, I definitely prefer the Vision and the Human Torch to be, you know, separate characters and separate, like, they can, you know, they can share some lineage, like they obviously do, like, you know, the Vision is some kind of evolution of the technology used to like create the Torch, but I don't like them tied together as like the same character. And this, I'm like Kurt Busiek. I like all my ducks in a row, and even if the ducks don't make any sense. And I mean, this is as good as, like, you know, what other writer is going to, like, especially modern writers, is going to like look at all this continuity and even as like kind of clunk ass as it is, like, try to like make it make sense, basically. Like, I mean, like, look at like that one part that annoys me is that when he's like, you know, oh, the Mad Thinker gave the Human Torch's body to Ultron. And then he like goes in the next room and he's like, oh, the Human Torch's body is still here, but I thought I gave it to Ultron. Oh, well, like, and like, that's like some like clunk ass like story mechanics, like continuity welding, but it's, you know, it's the best Busiek can do with what he was given. So like, I mean, you know, I, like I said, I like all my ducks in a row like he does. So like, I accept it, but like, I don't know, it's sometimes it's a little like, it's too much of a knot, I guess.
I don't know. For me, like, if you couldn't, I mean, obviously, like, some of this stuff that is being referenced in this issue are truly classic Avengers stories. So I could imagine, like, somebody, if they couldn't get, say, a page from Avengers 2 by Kirby, right? Like, maybe the next best thing would be, like, you know, the flashback panels to Avengers 2, or, you know, the flashback panels to the Avengers fighting the Masters of Evil with Immortus, or the Avengers 10, or, you know, whatever it is, right? And so, like, I look at all these and kind of am usually just kind of fascinated and kind of giddy over, like, oh, cool, like, this is the Galactic Storm page, and this is the page where, you know, they're doing Onslaught, or this is the page where Mantis is really a space phantom or whatever in the cross, you know, like, all that kind of stuff. But I'm just curious, like, do you guys have any particular, like, standout pages or moments or anything like that that you enjoy in this issue?
I hadn't really thought about it from that perspective. So I'm kind of paging through it quickly now and seeing. I mean, I just kind of, like, enjoyed running through the level of time on it and everything, but I can't say there's a specific event that's really the one. I guess, you know, as far as events go, the whole thing from, what was it, FF Annual number 4 with the Human Torch and Quasimodo and all of that, probably the most nostalgic for me.
Okay, yeah. No, that's cool. But see, like, that's the thing, right? Like, if you couldn't, you know, I guess that's the art collector thing in me. It's like, oh, well, if you can't get the FF Annual page, like, maybe this page from Avengers Forever is good enough. You know, like, or at least the next best thing.
The second and third pages with, like, the, you know, the cross, like, splash of Hawkeye with the Space Phantom are pretty cool. Like,
yeah, yeah.
But otherwise, yeah, it's just a bunch of, you know, retellings and, like, you know, Immortus talking to the, you know, Keepers of Time and whatever.
Right. I guess maybe I'll be the Paul in the scenario for the final splash, because the one thing that always kind of struck me as, like, a little funny is, I guess I know intellectually that Yellow Jacket is just blowing bubble gum, but, like, sometimes when I see that image, I'm like, is he smoking a cigar? Is he smoking a pipe? Like, I guess I think of, like, different things, because Immortus has, like, the smoke crackling in the back or whatever. And even though I know intellectually he's just, like, stretching the gum from his mouth on his glove or whatever he's doing there, like, for some reason, I tend to think of it as something else. And I don't know why, but for whatever reason, that little aspect of that, it's like a fantastic page, but for some reason that little aspect of it, like, weirds me out, I guess.
Well, even, you know, it is a dynamic page, but Yellow Jacket is drawn a little too thin for me.
Okay.
I mean, he's got, like, no waist whatsoever.
He's hot.
I don't know about that. But it's, I just feel like, you know, the proportions aren't quite right on him.
No, I get what you're saying. Both of them are pretty slim, right? Like, they're, I mean, he does tend to draw, like, slim and lanky individuals more so than, you know, the maybe massively ripped guys are even far and few between. Even when you come to guys like, you know, like, Thor looks pretty thick per se, but even you might argue, like, in some of the panels, right, maybe based on what you're saying, you might say, oh, well, his waist is still pretty slim, even though his upper torso is, like, huge, right? Like, so I see what you're saying.
And I you know, I would generally appreciate showing these characters as a little bit more lithe instead of just, you know, bulky and muscle bound, just because, especially in this era when the artists seem to take such glee in making them overly muscular. So I prefer to see somebody who's going to make them look more like a gymnast than a weightlifter. But on the other hand, you know, there is overdoing it to some extent.
They went too far into lean dancer than gymnast for you, right? Like,
yeah.
Okay, Bill, are we ready?
Sure, Paul. Oh, wait. Be right back. I need my Avengers Omnibus. Where did I put that thing?
While Bill looks for that, let me tell you about our new endeavor. Two True Freaks has grown, and Back to the Bins is growing with it. I, Paul Spataro, along with Bill Robinson and Scott Gardner.
Just say his name 3 times in an email and he'll appear in your show.
Hey, how's it going?
Ah! Sorry. I forgot I had a Scott Gardner life model decoy in here. Be right there. Ow! Oh, who put Cap's shield there?
Anyway, We're looking to showcase various characters, storylines, issues, or whatever strikes our fancy from the world of the Avengers.
Hey, Ben, move that funny-looking hammer, would you? It's on that book, and I can't move it.
Sure thing, Dad. Where do you want it?
Over there somewhere. No! Watch out for the repulsor! Ow! Don't tell your mother.
We like to call it Avengers Spotlight.
I thought it was going to be called Old Avengers Never Die. They just get reassembled and sent to another Earth. What? Too wordy?
Who knows what we'll cover, and who might stop by.
So join us for the Avengers Spotlight, where we'll look at Earth's greatest heroes and some of comics' greatest stories, such as the Korvac Saga, Acts of Vengeance, the Kree-Skrull War, and, oh, for the love of Christ, who the hell put the Celestial Madonna Saga on this list?
Huh. I found a use for that life model decoy after all. Okay, found it. We ready? Hey, wait a minute. This is the Book of the Vashanti.
Forget it. See you soon, everybody.
My favorite Avengers are D-Man and Green Lantern.
Say goodnight, Scott.
Goodnight, Scott.
All right. It sounds like we're coming to a close with issue 8. Maybe we can move on to the final issue we're going to cover in this installment, which is issue number 9. The title is Break: Reflections of the Conqueror, and of course the same credits as the previous issues. Kang the Conqueror, hidden away to lick his wounds in purgatory, reflects upon his entire existence. His potential ancestry with Victor Von Doom or Nathaniel Richards that led him to construct his time machine. His encounters with both the Fantastic Four and Doctor Doom as Rama Tut. His time as the Scarlet Centurion, and ultimately his time in the 40th century where his Kang the Conqueror armor and identity were fashioned. Kang conquered the planet Earth and led his armies against the alien Brotherhood of the Badoon. His first attempt to conquer the 20th century, that was foiled by the Avengers. Kang's conquests continued in both space and other dimensions, such as the otherworldly courts of cosmos. Kang's efforts to impress the daughter of King Carolus, Ravonna, where he tried to force the Avengers to serve him or die. However, Baltag, commander of Kang's elite guard, leads a coup against Kang and shoots Ravonna when attempting to assassinate Kang. Kang preserves Ravonna's body in stasis as he conquers the Shi'ar Empire. In a battle with Thor, Kang would flee to Limbo to discover the apparent corpse of Immortus. Claiming his technology as his own, Kang plucks Ravonna from the time stream right before she was shot. The action, among many others, led to uncountable divergent Kangs throughout the time stream. Those splintered selves battled the Fantastic Four, the Grandmaster, the Incredible Hulk, and led to the events of the Celestial Madonna Saga. There, Kang learned to master the art of mind transference to an alternate body moments before his disintegration at the hands of the mighty Thor. Kang then creates a Council of Kangs to not only organize his variant selves, but ultimately to destroy them. The events that led to Ravonna betraying Kang to Immortus and his undoing at the hands of Immortus's Psycho Globe. To offset the overwhelming memories of all his fractured selves contained within the Psycho Globe, Kang once again split himself into two beings, one that returned to his citadel and the other that perished with the Council of Kangs. The true Kang that returned to the citadel sought revenge against Mantis and came into conflict with the Fantastic Four that was led by Ben Grimm. Kang slowly found himself less a warrior and more a statesman, more and more destined to become Immortus. Still, Kang tried to defy his destiny and participated in the Infinity War alongside Doctor Doom, and would sacrifice himself for an alternate version of Ravonna in the events of Citizen Kang. Ravonna later revives Kang, but longing for simpler times, he returns to his Rama Tut identity in Egypt. Destined to fight his past self, Rama Tut fights Kang, hopelessly expecting a different outcome than he remembered. So Rama Tut returns to Chronopolis and dons the identity of Kang once more to defy the timekeepers and his ultimate destiny to become Immortus. Kang eliminates all his time-traveling rivals, such as the Time Variance Authority, the Lubric Consortium, Revelation, Alioth, and the Congress of Realities. He also eliminates the perceived crutch of being able to mind transfer to other bodies. Kang would study Immortus, He Who Remains, and the Timekeepers. This now brings us up to date with his alliance with Libra and the Supreme Intelligence, the fall of Chronopolis. Kang's reflections are then interrupted by that same Supreme Intelligence. Rick Jones,
bitch,
is taken to his chronosphere to the present, and he, the Supremor, and Kang form an alliance to defeat Immortus and the Timekeepers. Next up, the final battle begins. And so that, in a nutshell, is issue number 9 of Avengers Forever. And of course, I'll go with this one. We've got this cool, I think it's cool, this cool, nice cover of Kang. He is ripping open a statue of Immortus's head. And below the Immortus statue are all the statues of basically all his, I guess, variants and or ancestors. So you've got Nathaniel Richards, you've got Dr. Doom, you've got the Scarlet Centurion, you've got Rama Tut, and then you've got this kind of broken Immortus that Kang is trying to step through. And it is, it's reflective of his conflict in a cover scale artistic, you know, display of the I guess his internal conflict within this issue. So I think it's cool, but what do you guys think about it?
I actually think this might be the best cover so far. Woo-hoo. So I would agree with you that I think it's cool.
Yeah.
I just think it's, you know, again, it's giving us something from the story because it's showing us the, you know, basically the many layers of Kang, but it's also just an excellent, in my opinion, an excellent poster image at the same time. And, you know, we don't always get that as a combination. A lot of times when we get a poster image, that's all it is. But this is giving us something that's giving us a feel for the story within, which quite frankly, you know, could very easily make my head hurt because there's just so much going on as far as the, you know, the identity and what's going on, you know, between changing and, I'm impressed that you were able to synopsize it so well.
Thank you. I tried. I did my best.
Yeah, it's one of those images that if you're, you know, if you're Kang's biggest fan, like this is a pretty, like, you know, epic and like definite image of, like, you know, him and what his, you know, his long history and his whole deal is basically like. So
I guess that's why I fanboy out about this in particular, because I think this maxi series is my all time favorite interpretation of Kang. You know, this idea of, I mean, if we're using the Q analogy as Immortus, it's like imagine Worf somehow is destined to become Q, and he's like fighting that the whole time, kind of being like, no, I want to be a warrior, like I don't want to turn into Q, like, and it's I don't know, I guess maybe I appreciate and or identify with the conflict, right? Like that it's, and then to me it's fun to see, like, I guess I grew up reading like this whole council of Kang's time thing, you know, so I guess I have some amusement over, you know, seeing all that kind of reconciled. You know, I know they're, again, the pages are not numbered, but the page that has a flashback to, I believe it's FF, I want to say it's like 325 or 326 or something.
Durick is dead wrong. The issue is fantastic for 323 true believer.
But basically it's got like Kang holding Mantis and they're fighting the she thing, the what I like to call the super thing, you know, the extra spiky thing and the Human Torch. Like that was a book I was, you know, reading off the stands and everything. So that's like another moment for me to Leo DiCaprio and point my finger and go, like, I know that. And and I guess the Doom Kang team up in Infinity War, I think, is one of my favorites because it was stuff that used to drive me crazy as a kid, but now I kind of love it where, you know, Doom and Kang both agree to team up, but as they're shaking each other's hands in that book, they both have the thought balloons of, and then I will kill him. You know, like it's that trope of like, I'm going to shake your hand. I'm going to make this alliance with you only until it serves my needs. And then once you don't serve my needs anymore, I'm killing you. And like, so I don't know. I dig seeing all that kind of stuff, you know, sort of put on display. And, you know, I guess, you know, maybe this is a break from the quote unquote main story and the action. But I think it, you know, I think I'm always finding like new fun things to see in it, whether it's the He Who Remains, like the last Time Variance Authority, you know, it kind of made me dwell a little bit. You know, I don't follow this stuff as much as I used to, but it did make me think a bit about the season finale of the first season of Loki, right? Like thinking like, oh, that also presumably is a variant of Kang as well, right? And that you have like all these different forms of Kang in this story and how he's, I mean, the Rama Tut thing, I think, hits me hard too, because it's like that's like somebody trying to go back to simpler times, like escape their responsibilities, like maybe have a little more of a carefree existence, but then realizing, no, I have to get back into the grind. I have to put on my suit of armor and see if I can defy this destiny that I'm supposedly locked into, you know? So I don't know. I dig it. I think it's fun.
Yeah, I mean, do as well. I just think, like I said, I think it's very easily confusing. And I think Busiek does a great job of laying it all out in a way where if you, you know, this is not a book you can peruse. This is one where you have to sit and kind of go over it and say, okay, yeah, I got that. That makes sense. Now I can move on to the next thing. And little by little, and you probably got to keep even turning the page back a few times to say, wait a minute, what happened 3 pages ago there with, you know, with this character? Does that make sense? And it ultimately it does make sense, but it's a mind exercise to get through this, especially, you know, with the last issue where we're going through Immortus's history and interacting with the Avengers history, and now going through, you know, various histories with Kang. You know, there's just so much going on here. But again, I think Busiek does a great job of laying it all out.
It's certainly worth your $2.99. And I'll just throw in, if I'm really passionate about something, like I don't mind like going through the mind exercise of things. It's only when I feel like, you know, something is not, I don't know, as interesting or worth me, you know, or maybe it's a, you know, sometimes people go into these faux mind exercises, but I think this is a genuine one, and I was happy to be stretched, I guess.
Now this issue, I mean, if last issue was Busiek like cleaning up Avengers continuity, this is more focused on just Kang's like timeline and continuity. And you got to give him, you know, he must really like Kang himself if he was willing to look through like seems like virtually every Kang appearance and try to like tie them together with like Immortus's appearances and, you know, whatever else. So
it definitely is, you know, he pays tribute to the characters. And you know, when you said it's worth it because of what you're getting here, I agree. And the opposite of that would be the, you know, you spend all that time going through it and you say, well, that's, you know, whatever, 2 hours of my life I'm never going to have back.
Right.
You didn't feel that way after reading this.
Right.
Can you imagine, like, this was, like, over 20 years ago. Can you imagine if Busiek had to go back and, like, add in everything else that's been done with Kang, like, since this? Like,
not really. I mean, I like, this is my lament.
He'd have to make sense of all like Bendis nonsense and stuff.
Well, but that's why I feel like that. I guess that's why I put such high praise on this book, because I feel like it's the last gasp of a lost art that, I mean, he's trying to make sense of the continuity, and I think it was, you know, I think it still is like this Herculean, valiant effort. And furthermore, I think to Paul's point, it's like Kang's entire history, as complex and as much of a mind exercise as it is condensed into this issue. And like the fact that you can tell a story and go through a character's entire history right up to where they are in your story to get everyone on the same page. Like now you've lived his entire life with him. And now I hope the idea is now you're like, yeah, strap up, Kang, get those blasters. I'm ready to go into battle with you. You know what I mean? Like, I feel you. I'm on your side. F destiny. Like, let's do this. Let's see what we can do. Right. Like, and you feel like, I don't know. To me, it's like there's stuff that's exciting about that. But to answer your question, like if it keeps going further than that, I feel like the minute it gets into the 2000s and beyond, you know, because people kept trying to to walk back things or dump the quote unquote baggage, which, you know, I feel like is a misnomer. It's like you should cherish what is the history and the legacy of the books and not view it as baggage. And I do feel like Busick effectively did that. Like whether you love The Crossing, whether you love, you know, the FF annual, whether you love Burns West Coast Avengers run, whether you love the Cross Time Kang Council or you hate it, all of that stuff was treated as history, and he used it as forward momentum for this story, and it propels you into the next moment, which is, you know, him, he's going to ride off into battle with Rick Jones,
bitch,
and the Supreme War, and, you know, so, you know, I just think it's super effective. And again, I can't say enough good things about this.
Well, I think there's also the fact of, or the factor, where sometimes you have creators who take the past history and then they dump all over it. And to me, that bothers me because it shows a lack of respect for the creators who came before you. And that's, you know, they could be better than you, they could be worse than you, it doesn't matter. You know, I think you want to have some respect for the prior source material. And I think Busiek does that here. I think he, you know, he ties things together, but he never, I don't feel like he ever dumps on the prior stuff.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I, you know, I think that's very tactful and well done, and I appreciate it. It's you know, the thing I don't like, again, is when somebody takes a prior creator's work and then treats it as if it's not worthy of them. I often see that when you see a character, you know, a villain who has some, you know, history, and then a new creator takes it and just makes him, you know, just into a mort. Mm. And that bothers me when they do that. They show no respect for someone else's creation, you know, unless it's a character that was created to be a mort, which, you know, there are some of those out there, but, you know, it's, I'm trying to think of a specific example, and I know there's many, but I can't come up with one off the top of my head.
Well, I mean, I think you and I speak the same language. I mean, I always sort of refer to it as like a lot of well-established characters would get supplanted by the new hip popular character, right? So it's like, you know, for me, my go-to is, you know, and you guys covered this once, but it's like Doomsday, you know, beating the crap out of Darkseid, and Darkseid saying, "Oh, my Omega beams, they do not work." You know, I always hated that because you're like, well, wait, just because this character is the new hotness, now all of a sudden this character that basically makes everybody, you know, crap their pants and lives to the end of time and fights the Legion of Superheroes, now all of a sudden he doesn't hold a candle to Doomsday or whatever. And you know, to me, it's the same thing as, you know, to me, the T-Rex is, you know, I know it's not true, you know, maybe scientifically, but, you know, to me, the T-Rex is the end all be all, the king of the dinosaurs, right? But then, you know, you have the Jurassic Park movies where it's like, no, now we got Spinosaurus, and Spinosaurus is going to make the T-Rex look like a chump, you know? And it's like, I never liked that stuff. And so I, you know, I sympathize and also, you know, basically agree with you, right? Like if Kang is one of the Avengers, you know, preeminent villains, it would not make me happy if all of a sudden we'll pick on a character that Mike and I don't like, if the Hood shows up out of nowhere and makes Kang look like a punk just so Bendis can write something where the Hood, you know, takes over all of time travel or something, you know, and right, then that would cause us to have a collective groan, like Obi-Wan Kenobi's like, Bendis, I hear a collective groan across all planets or whatever.
You know? Bendis literally did that, Derek, like, or well, not the Hood, but like there was that like rebooted Avengers that like number one that like, I think, what did it take place after Siege or whatever? In whatever case, you know, when Captain America was back and like the issue opens with Kang like getting killed by those like next Avengers from that.
From that direct to video movie, right?
Yeah. So like it was like, oh, look, you know, here's this long established villain. And
speaking of that, like, you know what else Busick would have to contend with if this had kept going, or he did another history lesson or whatever? Like, I mean, then you have to throw like Iron Lad into the mix, right? Like, you wouldn't just have these four statues. Like, Iron Lad would be a statue somewhere in there, right?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, that's a whole nother like can of worms, basically. Because then you got the like the Kid Vision too, and
right, everything.
Yeah.
Well, I guess we're going a little off track, but does anybody have any final thoughts on this issue before we wrap things up?
I also thought that the ending of the issue was kind of cool, because now you have the alliance between Kang, Rick Jones,
bitch,
and the Supreme Intelligence. So we're drawing the battle lines before we get into the final battles.
Yeah.
So I thought, you know, that's worth mentioning. I thought that was pretty cool.
I do like that smile Kang has on that very last panel.
Oh, yeah.
Like, that's a cool image. Yeah. Uh-huh. This is one of, if you're Kang's biggest fan, I feel like this is a issue you're required to love, or at least, you know, like, cherish, basically. So
I think we need to just, you know, my final thought is I think we need to do issues 10, 11, and 12 soon, because I'm anxious to read them.
Well, and I want to echo that, because I feel like I'm running out of edit time to get these out by the time that we were planning to do them. So yeah, for sure, 100%. All right, guys. Well, thanks for listening. And I guess, I don't know, I feel like we could call it a night. Take care.
Yeah, I would just throw in at the end that this is the third part of the this particular retrospective, and the fourth part will be on the Fanholes podcast. So if you haven't already sought out part two on there, you need to do that. And then look for part four to come after this.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. This is the editorial box. The
yes. It's a little asterisk.
See other podcast you must listen to.
But yeah, thank you guys for doing this with me, and thank you for everybody for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you so much for listening to our show, and we hope you'll continue to join us each and every week for more good old-fashioned comic book back issue awesomeness. You can contact Back to the Bins to leave feedback, comments, questions, suggestions, and criticisms via email at bins@twotruefreaks.com or by joining the Back to the Bins group on Facebook. Back to the Bins is a proud affiliate of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, which you may find at www.twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is a registered trademark of DiManzo Corp of Milan, Italy. All rights reserved. Please take a moment to stop by the twotruefreaks.com site and check out their many other fine podcasts, won't you? Thanks, and we'll see you next week.
Well, I don't know if grading them, because, I mean, they're all pretty damn good, so I don't think...
I mean, nice. I think my thing was going to be like, it's all A's for me. I like these.
Yeah.
But I mean, but I'm biased. Like, that's because
they're all pretty super connected too. It's not like, you know,
it's not like the quality.
Yeah, it really is one story. So
right.
I wouldn't give my little cousin issue 7 of Avengers Forever as his first comic or anything. Like.